Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Cougar Conundrum, Sharing the World with a Successful Predator, by Mark Elbrock, narrated by Danny Campbell. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to visual elements present in the print and ebook formats of the book. "And I think in this empty world there was room for me and a mountain lion." D.H. Lawrence, Mountain Lion. Preface: Puma, cougar, panther, mountain lion, catamount, mountain screamer, painter, red tiger, leon, and leopardo are just several of the more than 80 common names that describe a graceful, stealthy predator that inhabits the largest range of any terrestrial mammal in the Western Hemisphere. Common names remain regional. In Florida, these animals are called panthers, and in the Pacific Northwest, cougars. In much of the remaining West, they are most often called mountain lions, or just lions for short. Taxonomists call this species Puma concolor. The genus name Puma means powerful animal in an old Incan dialect. The species name concolor means single color, and is meant to describe the uniform pelage of adult animals. In late 2017, Steve Eklund, host of a Canadian hunting television show, The Edge, posted public pictures on Facebook of himself and the dead mountain lion he had killed. He is an enthusiastic hunter and sportsman. He's an ambassador for Cabela's, the hunting equipment retail giant, and he'd posted similar images of other animals he'd hunted many times before. But, unexpectedly, this one caused a surge of public backlash that even included Laureen Harper, the wife of the former prime minister. She took the time to post this on Twitter. "What a creep! Must be compensating for something. Small penis, probably. It's a low blow to attack a man's genitalia." I barely registered the spike in social media surrounding Eklund and his trophy mountain lion, excepting that friends kept sending me links to the various articles about the incident. The year 2017 had already been full of sensational news about mountain lions attacking pets and livestock, as well as warnings about protecting children following mountain lion sightings in various Western neighborhoods. One lion was killed in urban downtown Salt Lake City. That incident raised some eyebrows, and there had been real excitement around a YouTube video of an encounter with a mountain lion on the High Sierra Trail in California. A pair of hikers glimpsed a mountain lion on the trail before them. That wasn't unusual, but then they pursued it when it trotted away from them. Around the next corner, they found themselves much too close to the animal, which had lain on the slope above the trail. The encounter was peaceful, and the cat did not show any signs of aggression that I could see in the videos I perused. Nevertheless, there were the inevitable debates about whether the hikers had acted appropriately or been foolish and were lucky to have survived. There is a near constant back and forth on various social media outlets between groups of individuals with different opinions about mountain lions, and nowadays I only half listen. It's like the static you hear on a handheld receiver, which every biologist learns is a distraction from the real signal indicating the direction of the animal you are looking for. At the same time that Eklund found himself the center of a cyberstorm, I was trying very hard to block out any lurid news about mountain lions so I could write a book on the little-known social behaviors of the species. Simultaneously, however, the Humane Society of the United States was initiating a signature campaign to end bobcat and mountain lion hunting in Arizona, and Safari Club International was petitioning the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth District to reverse the ban on mountain lion hunting in California. These developments were more difficult to ignore. They represented bolder, more strategic efforts to impact mountain lion management that were being orchestrated by lobby groups representing different private citizen stakeholders. Both efforts failed, but I followed them closely. In early 2018, there was a further distraction when the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, USFW, announced the extinction of the eastern cougar, a subspecies of mountain lion. I found myself sucked into debates and confusion over the ruling and its implications for mountain lions across North America. The truth is that recent genetic research has shown that there never was a distinct eastern cougar in the first place, and that the media was emphasizing all the wrong aspects of the ruling. Then, in May 2018, a mountain lion attacked two mountain bikers in Washington State, killing one. A fellow researcher dispatched the animal, which was a young male, grossly underweight, but otherwise healthy. It was the first mountain lion fatality in Washington State in some 90 years, but the media spread the story and its associated drama from coast to coast. Then it was back to pet and livestock attacks and more fear-mongering public warnings about mountain lions that had been spotted in western neighborhoods, some near schools. By the time authorities in Oregon had announced the heartbreaking news that a mountain lion had killed a woman in Mount Hood National Forest in September, I'd given up writing a book about mountain lion social behaviors. She was the first person ever killed by a mountain lion in Oregon, but given that she was the second person killed by a mountain lion in the United States in 2018, the incident resulted in renewed debate over mountain lion hunting. Every mountain lion story in the news eventually comes down to hunting. Instead of writing on social behaviors, I kept finding myself penning notes to address the mix of facts and misinformation about mountain lions and their management found on social media, facts and non-facts used like bludgeons by both wildlife and hunting advocates to quell their opposition. Or I'd find myself trying to explain the political arena in which mountain lion management operates, which serves as a starting place for discussing how hunting impacts the social organization of the species. People are angry. We, and I include myself, are frustrated with the state of things. We want answers. And more importantly, we want to be heard, to feel that those in power listen to us as people invested in wildlife and its management. How many mountain lions are there? Are they really killing all the elk and deer? Are they really a risk to our pets, our livestock, or our children? Do we really need mountain lions in natural systems in the first place? I decided that I can always write a book about mountain lion social behaviors. What was needed now was a guide to sifting facts from sensationalism. The frenzy of media activity surrounding mountain lions in 2017 and 2018 was not new, just more of what has become the new normal. Time and again, people have risen up to condemn mountain lions and call for increased control of their populations, if not their complete eradication. In response, the opposition has risen up to defend the cats, blaming humans and our encroachment into mountain lion habitat for every tragic incident. Certainly the details on each mountain lion story in the news were different, but the buzz, the anger, the frustration, and the hateful rhetoric wielded by opposing sides have been redundant again and again. They were not mere reactions to any single happenstance, but symptoms of a much larger problem we currently face in North America, the cougar conundrum. In 2016, P-45 was a young male mountain lion living in and around Malibu in the Santa Monica Mountains northwest of Los Angeles, California. He had a name and a number because he wore a GPS collar and was being followed by Seth Riley and Jeff Sikich, scientists for the National Park Service. They researched the local mountain lion population and its chances for survival, given its isolation from other mountain lion populations to the north and southeast. They predict the Santa Monica mountain lion population will go extinct unless we can build wildlife bridges over Highway 101 to facilitate connectivity with other mountain lions to the north. The mountain range is hemmed in by the Pacific Ocean on one side and Southern California suburban sprawl on the other, limiting opportunities for any mountain lion to come or go from the tiny 275-square-mile mountain range. Worse, the area has been made an island by the 10-lane highway that runs its length to the north. Today, researchers and wildlife advocates work to save a mountain lion population that, just 60 years previously, was likely extirpated following state-paid bounties for dead mountain lions. Between 1907 and 1963, California paid out 12,461 bounties for mountain lion carcasses. During the first half of the 20th century, the state employed up to 5 people dedicated solely to the hunting and killing of mountain lions. Jay Bruce was among them, credited with killing more than 700 California mountain lions over 28 years of service. Even though LA's entertainment industry dominates local culture, Southern California is a difficult place for most mountain lions to gain media attention. That is because in LA, P-22 reigns as king. P-22 somehow miraculously survived crossing 8 lanes of commuter traffic on the 405 and 8 to 10 lanes of traffic on the 101, both mammoth highways with dense traffic at every time of day and night. He was discovered inhabiting the tiny urban wilderness of Griffith Park in 2012, when a local biologist, Miguel Ordinana, caught an image of him on a motion-triggered camera. It was like finding an image of Bigfoot or the Chupacabra, Ordinana later explained. P-22 was immortalized in 2013 when National Geographic photographer Steve Winter captured an image of him walking beneath the iconic Hollywood sign. 3 years later, however, P-45 grabbed the limelight for a while, but for all the wrong reasons. In a single night, he killed 10 alpacas on a ranch beside the Mulholland Highway in Malibu. Having lost alpacas to lions in the past, the ranch was not without its defenses. Victoria Von Perling had strung up solar-powered lights and added flagging to the top of the fence enclosing the animals in order to give the illusion that it was taller. She even rigged up a radio to blast talk radio just to keep her livestock safe. But on Thanksgiving in 2016, heavy rain destroyed Von Perling's defenses, shorting the radio and stopping the lights from recharging. In the silence and darkness that resulted, P-45 slipped in and for some reason killed more than he could eat, unusual behavior for a mountain lion. Von Perling, discovering the carnage the next morning, contacted the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and requested a depredation permit to pursue and legally kill the lion. She'd had enough. It was time to remove the perpetrator. The result was an eruption of public outcry as had never been experienced for mountain lions anywhere. On the one side were angry livestock owners, led by a colorful character named Wendell Phillips, who was neighbor to Von Perling and had earlier wounded P-45 after the lion killed an alpaca on his property. Livestock owners presented their case as follows. 1. There were too many mountain lions prowling the area. 2. P-45 was dangerous to people as well as animals. 3. P-45 was abnormal and seemed to enjoy killing. And 4. P-45 should be removed permanently. Phillips called P-45 the John Wayne Gacy of mountain lions, referring to a notorious 1970s serial killer. On the other side, animal rights and mountain lion advocates argued that 1. Livestock owners were to blame for livestock conflict. 2. Proper enclosures for livestock would solve everything. And 3. P-45 was too valuable to the local mountain lion population to lose. Mountain lions were, in fact, a species of special concern and had been awarded full protection in the Golden State, and their population in the Santa Monica Mountains was particularly vulnerable. Local advocates knew a great deal about the state of local mountain lions because there was active research being conducted on the population. Seth Riley and Jeff Sikich, the biologists who tracked P-45, supported their arguments, explaining that P-45 was one of just 2 resident male mountain lions in the entire mountain range at the time, and one that had somehow traveled across the 101 from the north to infuse the local mountain lion population with new genetic material. P-45 was therefore a critical animal to conserve in the Santa Monica Mountains. Von Perling and Phillips subsequently received death threats from militant wildlife advocates for requesting a permit to kill P-45. In response, livestock owners retorted that they would not just shoot lions, but also any people they found skulking on their properties, and discourse on social media deteriorated rapidly. Most mountain lion incidents stop there, with everyone fighting. But the Malibu community rallied and conducted productive public and private meetings about what to do about P-45 and local mountain lions more broadly. The discussions were at times heated and loud, but everyone had the opportunity to speak their mind. Under public pressure, many argue, Von Perling changed her mind and did not pursue her right to kill P-45 after he killed 10 of her alpacas on that terrible night. She told media that her intention had always been that the state would relocate the animal, not kill it. The results of P-45's carnage, the international outrage that followed, and the public meetings about what to do in response were overall incredibly positive, even if unsatisfactory to all involved. There were a flurry of letters to the editor of the Los Angeles Times, some defending the livestock owner's right to kill the animal, and others calling for non-lethal solutions to the conflict. In the end, Von Perling erected 4 10-by-10-foot chain-link enclosures, and now, every night, she shepherds her remaining alpacas inside these structures to shield them from P-45 and other lions. The enclosures were designed, supplied, and built on-site by the nonprofit Mountain Lion Foundation and paid for by the National Wildlife Federation in what many tout as role model support from mountain lion advocates who put their money where their mouth is and provide feasible solutions to livestock conflict. P-45 still roams and contributes to the local mountain lion population, occasionally killing less protected livestock. P-45 and the other lions will inevitably continue to kill vulnerable livestock in the region, unless similar defensive measures are undertaken more broadly. This is part of the reality of living with livestock in mountain lion country. In 2018, California changed its policy to a 3-strike rule with regard to issuing depredation permits in the region surrounding the Santa Monica Mountains, in order to further protect the remaining mountain lions there. Owners are now required to try non-lethal methods 2 separate times to deter repeat livestock killing, and only if that fails will the state wildlife agency issue a permit to kill the offending lion. Mountain lion advocates were thrilled with this outcome, but some livestock owners were outraged. Wendell Phillips said it will encourage vigilante justice. "The reality is nobody will bother to apply for permits anymore," he predicted. "Shoot, shovel, and shut up. That's what's coming." Nevertheless, I would argue that, at least on a local scale, the Malibu community wrestled with the cougar conundrum and came up with a solution. Not everyone involved was happy with the end result, but it is the process that's most important, not the outcome. People from opposing sides participated and contributed to a solution that worked for the livestock owner who suffered losses, and also for the larger community. A century ago, we tried very hard to eradicate mountain lions from the United States and Canada, and we failed. We did succeed in most of the East, except for a few stragglers hiding in Florida swamplands. Some of these elusive, intelligent animals, however, retreated to mountain strongholds in the West and thwarted our every effort to eliminate them. They survived for so long that American culture began to change and to articulate an appreciation for predators as part of healthy ecosystems. Aldo Leopold, for example, stopped killing wolves and began promoting them. What followed was the end to the bounty hunting of mountain lions and a switch to managing mountain lions with fixed hunting seasons, which imposed limits on the number of animals that could be killed each year. Then something miraculous happened, something no one would have predicted at the time. the mountain lions that survived the onslaught of previous decades emerged from hiding and began to find each other and mate. Their populations rebounded with unexpected vitality and quickly spread into areas where they had previously been exterminated. In parts of the West, mountain lions may now be as abundant as they were in historic times before European settlement, and in some areas, they might be more abundant. Mountain lions are, without doubt, among the most successful conservation stories of the last century, and yet few people seem to appreciate this fact or even to acknowledge it. We actually helped a species bounce back from near extinction, and it is now, on its own, gradually recolonizing areas where it was eradicated a century ago. The heart of the cougar conundrum is this. Can we peacefully coexist with such a successful predator? The answer is yes, of course we can. More to the point, the question is, will we choose to peacefully coexist with such a successful predator? That is a question I cannot answer. But given the increasing polarization surrounding mountain lions, the us versus them so visible in media surrounding mountain lions and reflective of larger patterns in American culture, the more likely it is that we will remain mired in power struggles and minor social media fights while avoiding the core issues altogether. Today, there are more mountain lion advocates and advocacy organizations than ever before, while at the same time, we are killing record numbers of mountain lions in the United States each year. We kill scores of mountain lions to aid bighorn sheep recovery across the Southwest, while simultaneously, Los Angeles residents are raising $87 million to build a bridge spanning 10 lanes of pavement to save P-45 and a handful of mountain lions in the Santa Monica Mountains. State and federal agencies fund the killing of predators that kill livestock, but they don't fund infrastructure to protect livestock. These are ironies reflective of the quandary we face. This book is a detailed accounting of the current conundrum, or, more specifically, a discussion of a collection of conundrums born of rebounding mountain lion populations. The book's chapters are thematic, each focusing on a single conundrum. Chapter 1, for example, begins with, "What is a mountain lion?" In 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt wrote, "No American beast has been the subject of so much loose writing or of such wild fables as the cougar." More than a century later, the same might still be said. Theodore Roosevelt became uniquely involved in the national debate over the ecological accuracy of the published literature, especially the materials being provided to educate students of the era. He had grave concerns about authors who broadly became known as the nature fakers, those who fabricated myths about the workings of the natural world. Mountain lion mythology, born of the 19th and early 20th centuries, remains the core of the cougar conundrum. This book, however, is more than straight documentation. Somewhat reluctantly, I step beyond the comfort zone of a working mountain lion biologist and provide bold speculation and suggestions about how we might escape becoming mired in the conundrum. Chapters 2 and 3 address human and livestock safety issues. Chapter 4 discusses the influence of mountain lions on the ungulate population so valued by hunters, as well as the state agency programs that serve them. Chapter 5 assesses how mountain lions are faring in a modern world, and Chapter 6 explores eastern mountain lions, from sightings to migrants to Florida panthers. Chapter 7 is a discussion of the tactics we might employ to build social capital for mountain lions. Everything culminates in Chapter 8, in which we explore who is making and who should be making decisions about mountain lion management. More to the point, it is a story of the money and power dynamics that drive wildlife management. Chapter 9 is a discussion of what might come next, depending upon the choices we make now. The components of forward movement seem quite plain, even if complicated by power dynamics, outdated ideals, and entrenched bureaucracy. First, we must weed out myths and share an understanding of the real mountain lion. Second, We must answer people's questions and concerns about mountain lions. Third, we must come to some consensus around the legal hunting of mountain lions, as well as what to do when a mountain lion kills pets or livestock, or, in the rare cases, when one attacks a person. Fourth, we must exercise inclusive and transparent mountain lion management. Parallel with these milestones, we must also foster greater tolerance for mountain lions and large predators more broadly in our culture and around the world. We must choose how we live with mountain lions, essentially how we might share natural resources like habitat, deer, and elk with them. Myself, I hope we choose peaceful coexistence over any other alternative. People with extreme views are currently driving the discourse about mountain lions, and we need to be reminded that these views are not representative of most people. Like cornered mountain lions, people sometimes bare their claws when they find themselves on the defensive. Devolving into a social media troll and engaging in mudslinging on Twitter does not help. In fact, that perpetuates the problem. We are a proudly democratic society. All people are entitled to opinions, and each perspective is valid. Livestock losses, for example, are tragic and hard on real people. Take a deep breath and let down your defenses. Enjoy the stories. Be open to learning something new about mountain lions. My goal was to write a book about these animals that no one would throw down in disgust, regardless of their values and beliefs. Instead, I've tried to be brutally honest, to present the facts as I see them, and to tell stories that educate and entertain. We must bridge the divides that separate the many factions invested in mountain lions, and work together to ensure a future that includes healthy populations of mountain lions and people. Malibu did it, and so can we on a national and international scale. Chapter 1. The Lord of Stealthy Murder and Other Misconceptions. A pair of snowmobiles ripped through the mountains northeast of Jackson, Wyoming at dawn, their whining engines a profanity in the still silence of that wild place. Patrick Lendrum and Michelle Piziol were driving, clad in one-piece suits and helmets that covered and protected every inch of skin from the bitter cold. They were biologists for Panthera's Teton Cougar Project, and the project included some unusual methods. GPS collars worn by mountain lions relayed the locations of the animals in near real time to the project's computers via satellites orbiting the Earth. Patrick and Michelle spent their days racing to set motion-triggered cameras in areas where mountain lions lingered long enough that their behaviors could be recorded. They did so, even knowing they might encounter a mountain lion in the remote terrain. When Michelle and Patrick arrived on site that morning, they found the snowmobile trail stippled with fresh lion footprints. Michelle set to stomping out M58's footprints in order to hide his presence from humans who might harass him, or worse. Patrick dropped away from the groomed snowmobile trail and waded through deep snow toward open water. The Gros Ventre River raged nearby, loud and raucous, rolling the rocks in exposed rapids rushing between patches of ice. Patrick spotted the hind end of an elk protruding from the icy water not 20 feet away from him, the legs oddly vertical, as if the animal had frozen in position before it was pulled from the river. He yelled to Michelle that he'd found the kill, but the noise of the river swallowed his words. Michelle worked until she was satisfied that no trace of lion remained, and then she moved toward the river to join Patrick. She stepped off the trail and, thunk, sunk up to her waist in deep, soft snow. She shrieked in merriment, and while still laughing at her own predicament, she looked toward Patrick. He had moved along the exposed shoreline to a large Engelmann spruce about 10 feet from the carcass, an ideal place to set a camera, she thought. Her smile faltered and fell, however, when she locked eyes with M58 staring at her from the base of the tree. Adrenaline surged through her body. Time slowed. The lion stood elevated 4 feet above the ground on a nest of tangled roots, exposed by high waters in years past. He'd been lying below the overhanging foliage of the spruce tree, which provided a roof while he rested. M-58 was a curved 4¾ feet, 144 centimeters, from the tip of his nose down along...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?